Tom Woods Show, episode 2029.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and fail to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of the Tom Woods Show is membership inside the Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am so happy to have Mark Crispin Miller back with us once again. Mark is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University. He teaches a course on propaganda. We've talked about that a little bit in the past. So, of course, Mark is an especially valuable asset to us these days, obviously. And he's undergone some real trials at his university because of things he's said in the classroom, stuff like that. And he's a fascinating guy. And I want to get an update on what's going on there and just have a free-flowing discussion with him. There's never been a bad one. Never an uninteresting conversation with Mark Crispin Miller. Mark, welcome back.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Let's talk about what's been happening with you. I have to be honest, I don't know completely, but I've gotten bits and pieces from listeners of mine who have become fans of yours. So first, let's refresh people's memory about first, who you are, and secondly, the position you've been in. I don't know how I would describe you, really, how I would classify you. And I think you're the kind of person who, in some ways, defies classification, and I would bet is kind of annoyed by classification. But I would say I would describe you as being on the left before it became completely insane, and as somebody who takes genuinely anti-establishment positions, and that includes Hillary Clinton and the whole, you know, mainstream Democratic Party establishment. And you're willing to say unpopular things, even when it comes to the present medical madness. And on top of all this, you've been teaching, among other things at NYU, a course on, of all things, propaganda, which is, I would think, would be rather valuable knowledge to have right about now. And you got into some trouble because, well, frankly, you exposed your class to both sides of the argument about the effectiveness of masks. And that wound up getting you in some trouble. Can you, first of all, fill in anything that you critical that you think I left out? But that's kind of where we left the story the last time we spoke.
That's right. Well, you say I'm hard to classify, but clearly I am on the far right, as you are, right? I mean, aren't we both on the far right?
According to CNN, there is no other place to put us.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's an inversion of the old red baiting smear. You know, once upon a time, if you took a dissident position, you were vilified as communist or a communist sympathizer. I'm old enough to remember that. Now we see the opposite. We see the so-called left attacking as far right anyone who counters the official narrative. So anyway, I'm only being half facetious there. I am on the far right. Who am I? I've been a professor since the 70s, focusing primarily on media, and over the last 20 years or so on propaganda in particular. And I have indeed been, or I should say had been, teaching a very popular course on propaganda for roughly the last 20 years or so. And that has everything to do with how and why I got into trouble at NYU, where I've been teaching since 1997. I am a tenured full professor. And I'm going to recount my sin, confess my sin. In September of 2020, year COVID, I was, as usual, teaching my propaganda course and explaining to the class that while we would be looking into the history of modern propaganda since World War I, our main focus was going to be on propaganda in real time, because I don't regard the study of propaganda as an antiquarian exercise or an academic pursuit, but as really as a crucial democratic activity. Studying propaganda critically is essential, it seems to me. And I was explaining, I explained to the class that what this necessarily means is that you have to be prepared to move out of your comfort zone if you're going to make an attempt at studying propaganda with any kind of impartiality. Because while it is easy for all of us to perceive propaganda that we disagree with, we have a very hard time perceiving it when we agree with it, when it pushes our buttons. So explaining all this to the class, as I always do. And then to provide some examples of the kind of thing we might do in the class, I pointed out that we were meeting remotely, just as you and I are now meeting remotely, and that this odd and unpleasant innovation obviously has everything to do with the COVID crisis, which I noted had been driven by a cluster of very powerful propaganda themes. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're false, because propaganda can be accurate. But even when it's accurate, it's often one-sided and can always be misleading. Therefore, we need to study it as thoroughly as we can. For instance, I said, take the mask mandates. If one were to study the mask mandates as propaganda, or if you're going to write your papers on that subject, you would naturally want to read all the scientific literature out there on the subject of the efficacy of masks as a barrier to the transmission of respiratory viruses. And I mentioned to the class, you may be interested to know that all the randomized controlled trials on the subject have found, without exception, that masks are not effective barriers. And I explained why and so on. So you would want to read those studies, and then you would want to go on to read the more recent studies finding otherwise, because I know you remember, Tom, that a bunch of hasty studies came tumbling out in the summer of 2020 purporting to find that masks are effective. I said, I didn't make any secret of my own position, but I said, this is all about your learning how to review all the pertinent material on a given subject and then making up your own mind about it. So you'd want to read those studies that find that masks are effective barriers to respiratory viral transmission. I gave them some advice on how a non-scientist might assess a new scientific study. And that was pretty much it. Now, the following week, a student emailed me and asked if she could join us late. And as usual, I said, of course, the more the merrier, welcome. Well, to make a long story short, the following week, the subject came up again in class. The student had missed the introductory discussion and said nothing, although I could see, even remotely, that she was not happy. And a few days after that class, which was on a Thursday, the student was on Twitter demanding that I be fired for putting the students at risk. She was fit to be tied. Now, this was not pleasant for me and rather a surprise, because I'm used to students bringing up their objections in the classroom, which is always extremely valuable, pedagogically. But that didn't bother me so much. Her public denunciation and demand that I be fired weren't that big of a deal, but it was a big deal, and it is a big deal that NYU immediately took her side. My department chair tweeted his thanks to her, and in the name of the department, assured her that they were discussing next steps. This, Tom, has to do with my firing, okay? So without having even spoken to me, he went right up on Twitter and said, yes, thank you. We are concerned as you are, and so on. So that happened. The following day, the dean of my school and the doctor who dictates COVID rules at NYU, which are, quite draconian, took it upon themselves to email my other students without putting me on copy, intimated that I had given them dangerous misinformation, and providing a list of links to those recent studies, and essentially telling the students to believe those, which is the opposite of what I do. I had also recommended that they read those studies, but I didn't tell them that they contained the gospel truth, but these two bureaucrats did. And then the day after that, I was informed that it would be better for the department if I did not teach the propaganda course the following semester, which would have been last spring. I asked why, and I was told it was because the enrollments in my film course, I teach a film course, are very high and the numbers would be good for us, etc. The only problem with that pretext is that the propaganda and film classes are the same size. You know, they're both, the ceiling in both is 24. So this was a transparent, as I say, pretext to get me to stop teaching the course. So I had to do that, but I did it under protest. Well, as I've told you all this before, you know, as your audience will know, in fact, yours is one of the first shows I did after this whole thing blew up. I posted a petition on change.org in the name of all those who had been gagged or punished for their dissidence, and not just throughout year COVID, but really forever.
That petition did pretty well, as I recall.
It did quite well. Tens of thousands of people signed it, including a number of quite eminent people. And this infuriated my department colleagues. It made them so angry that they drafted a letter to the dean, which began with the assurance that they believe in academic freedom, you know. And Tom, I now know that when somebody says that, you better watch it because there's a big but coming.
And yeah, if for some reason, this seems to be a universal rule of life. Last week, I had a flight canceled where they took us off the plane, but then they said, the flight is not canceled. We just took you off the plane. When they say the flight is not canceled, they mean the flight is canceled. I don't know why this is a universal rule, but it's particularly sinister with, we believe in academic freedom. The but is always the central part of that sentence.
Right. It basically comes down to, we believe in academic freedom, but not for you. You know?
Right.
Yeah, they believe in it. All right. So they assured the dean that they believe in academic freedom. And then they made the case that when a colleague's behavior is sufficiently heinous, that colleague has forfeited his or her academic freedom. And so it was with me, they claimed, demanding an expedited review of my conduct. You just have to picture the scare quotes around those words. In light of the fact that I had engaged in really egregious behavior in the classroom, not only had I told my students not to wear masks, which was just a bald-faced lie or a delusion, in defiance of a New York state law, they said, and there is no such law, but I had engaged in routine hate speech, mounted attacks on students and others in our community, was guilty of aggressions and microaggressions, a whole bunch of other things that were completely fantastic and not in the colloquial sense of really great.
Right.
Imaginary, you know.
Yeah.
Just insane.
Fantasy.
This took my breath away. And I only found out about this because the dean sent it to me as an attachment. This was a month after the student went on Twitter. This was on October 20th, I think. He sent me this letter, or forwarded me this letter saying, I have gone ahead and ordered this review. I mean, he hadn't even talked to me. So this was flabbergasting. I didn't know what to do. The provost here advised me to have a meeting with the dean. So I did. And he told me they were going to conduct a review that would end by mid-December. I asked what it would entail. And he said, we'll talk to people, faculty and students. I said, well, faculty haven't seen me teach. He said, okay, students, we'll talk to students.
This is ridiculous. You have to explain to him what the review should consist of.
The whole thing was surreal. He didn't really seem to be that clued in, you know? And the most significant thing he said to me was, when I asked him why he went ahead and ordered the review without even talking to me, he said the university lawyers had told him he must, okay, which I regard as significant. Now, two things. On the one hand, there's the narrative of the review, and I'm going to get to that in a moment because there's some news on that front. The other thing is that I, after this conversation with the dean, I went through my colleague's letter very carefully and crafted a rebuttal point by point and asked for a retraction and an apology. and they did not reply. I waited a week and I sent a follow-up request. And again, I was ignored. So I decided that I had no choice but to sue them for libel. That is 19 of the 25 signatories on that letter. The other six are junior faculty, and I didn't really want to sue them. So I sued, and am suing 19 of my department colleagues for libel because the claims they made about me were absurd, demonstrably false, or deluded, you know, and that their intention was to get me fired, which is clearly malicious. All right. So very quickly, they got themselves a lawyer. They filed a motion to dismiss. And since then, this has been in the judge's handball court. Since February, we're waiting for him to rule on the motion to dismiss. And if he grants it, we will appeal. I mean, I've raised a fair amount of money on GoFundMe, you know, because this is not about me, Tom. This is about all of us. And it seems to me that if we don't stand up and say no to this kind of thing, it will never end. Whereas if we do say no, there is a chance that we could actually prevail and, you know, rediscover true academic inquiry, proper classroom practice, and real science, you know, just to name a few things, but not to mention journalism that's worthy of the name. We have to say no to these lies and to this bullying. So we're still waiting for the judge to rule on the motion to dismiss. As I say, if he grants the motion, we'll appeal. And if he denies the motion, as I believe he should, we will simply proceed. Okay, now the review. Spring came, I should say mid-December came and went. I heard nothing about the review. The spring semester came and went. I heard nothing about the review. And this was last spring, spring of 2021. And I was quite ill. I'm battling chronic Lyme disease, and the stress of this whole thing actually landed me in NYU hospital in late January. So I was on medical leave that semester. I heard nothing. Summer went by, I heard nothing. And all this semester, nearly all of it went by and I heard nothing until last Wednesday, when I was summoned to see the dean for a follow-up conversation, you know, since our last exchange, which was over a year before. All right, here's the news. He told me right off the bat that their review had found that I did not violate any NYU policy, which was really very good news.
Especially since, let's be blunt about it, they obviously were looking hard for it. They obviously wanted you to have violated something. Am I being too cynical?
No, you're not at all, not in the least, because I mean, I could go on and on about this and have been known to, but that move against me in September of 2020 was actually the third attempt to bring me down that year. I didn't know until I read the exhibits that my colleagues submitted with their motion to dismiss that a significant number of them had been highly exercised about me and my work for years. I really had no idea. I mean, I thought they didn't care what I did and, live and let live, et cetera. But I now know from their own internal correspondence that they've been really upset about my conspiracy theorizing and other things. But, you know, they, none of them ever spoke to me. None of them ever asked me if, something I allegedly said in class was what I'd actually said, you know, because they were indeed looking for reasons to come after me. And I believe that it wasn't just those colleagues, but I think it was those colleagues with a lot of encouragement from on high. At any rate, the dean told me I was not guilty of any violation of NYU policy and that they were going to let the matter go. But then he proceeded to go into some detail, well, actually not any detail, but he proceeded to spend time explaining to me that while I had not violated any NYU policy, he was very concerned that a significant number of students that's his phrase, had expressed great unhappiness over my teaching and that I should therefore reconsider my teaching style and even think about getting coached in how to teach.
Oh, right.
Now, I had to make an effort to control my temper.
Yeah, of course. And of course, you'd be coached by one of these ghouls. No, thank you.
Well, yeah, yes. You know, when I talked to him in the fall of 2020, I had told the dean that I was going to have students submit letters on my behalf and letters as well from people who had been in my classes as visitors. And he said, fine. And they got well over 50 of such letters, which were really glowing and very moving to me personally. And those letters comprised the only upside of this whole dismal experience. So I said that I could conceivably reconsider my teaching style if I could have some specific examples, some specific complaints, you know, anonymous, of course, if they could just forward me some of these statements about how oppressive it was in my classroom. I might have something to go on. And what's interesting is that he would not. Most of our meeting from that point on was devoted to my repeated request for some specificity, and he wouldn't do it. So I don't think there's much there. My feeling is that there was not a whole lot there for them to show me. I am confident that my teaching is quite effective. And indeed, I have to say, Tom, that a number of the students who wrote in my defense made the point that my classes are unusually tolerant and open. Everyone feels able to speak up, to express their views without any fear of being canceled in the classroom.
I've never been in one of your classes, and I know for a fact that that's how they are. Well, I just know it.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I pride myself on precisely that, you know, and I have had a significant number of students, to use the dean's phrase, come up to me after certain classes and tell me very quietly, furtively, they were really grateful that they could talk honestly about their views on this or that subject without feeling, you know, at risk of being shamed for departing from the orthodoxy, you know, the social justice ideology primarily. So here I was being accused by people who actually do, you know, harass and silence their students of doing that to students, which I never do. At any rate, let's stress the good news. Let's accentuate the positive and note that NYU seems to have decided to distance itself from my colleague's letter because their whole argument, the reason they wrote the letter was that I had clearly violated NYU policy with my teaching, my hateful teaching. And here NYU was telling me that you did not violate any such policy. So we now simply continue to wait for the judge to rule and then we'll proceed from there. You know, meanwhile, the problem that my situation has typified is, as I don't have to tell you, serious now. I mean, really frightening. And not just here, but all over the world, free speech and academic freedom are under unprecedented assault as the powers that be continue to exploit the COVID crisis for the purpose of radically reinventing global society, and in so doing, trying to create a future in which free speech and other such hoary constitutional ideals are inconceivable. You know, that's what they want. They want a world without argument, just as the monopolists like Bill Gates, you know, and the Rockefellers who have been funding this whole nightmare are actually intent on getting rid of all competition, you know, economically. They don't believe in competition. So do they not believe in argument, which is to say that they don't believe in science, despite their constant cynical emphasis on the science. They don't believe in science because they don't believe in challenging official claims. And they don't believe in dissidents. They don't believe in democratic discourse. They are stone totalitarians. And so the sort of local struggle that I've been engaged in at this one university is simply one of many, many signs of an intensifying totalitarian order. So I am resolute. I'm going to see this libel suit through and continue to try to tell the truth as I see it, as I'm doing here with you.
Hey, folks, let's say a quick word for our sponsor, Skillshare. We're living at a time when I think a lot of us feel our spirits just ground down by the news and what's happening in society. And frankly, we could all use something that lifts us up, that gives us purpose, that fills our hearts with joy. And Skillshare is just the thing. It's an online learning community with thousands and thousands of classes across a wide range of creative areas. So we're talking animation, photography, illustration, design, but also productivity, entrepreneurship. I was just looking through a new class on indoor gardening. So we're talking about houseplants, veggies, herbs. It's a tremendous variety of ways to get out of your comfort zone, explore something new, or build upon something you're already kind of good at and get even better. Now, because I'm a nerd who loves productivity and efficiency, I've taken Productivity for Creatives, Build a System That Brings Out Your Best by Thomas Frank. These are all manageable classes of often very short duration that get right to the point. You can do a class project, get feedback from a great community, and bring a little light into your soul during a dark time. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods, where our listeners get a 1 month free trial of premium membership. That's 1 month free at Skillshare.com/woods.
Well, I'm going to ask you something maybe you don't want to answer, and I would understand that completely, but the elephant in the living room here, in addition to the facts of the case everybody knows about, is the vaccine mandate there and now the booster mandate. How are you coping with that?
This is an interesting thing. I filed for a religious exemption just to make sure your audience is clear that indeed NYU, like many, many other schools, mandated quote unquote vaccination months ago for all members of the community. And now they just came out, I think yesterday, adding that all members of the community have to get booster shots.
Yeah.
So I applied for a religious exemption in all sincerity, because I'll tell you, as I told them, that this dystopian experience has really moved me spiritually. And I'm not the only person who once identified as leftist who feels this way now. I believe that we're all but coming face to face with evil. I think this is a profoundly evil project. I think it is a eugenicist project. I think that its authors are after absolute and permanent control and a radically reduced global population. And this is not a conspiracy theory. I mean, their involvement with an interest in eugenics is well established. And even though they may not use that word, they are definitely interested in depopulation. I mean, Bill Gates has been explicit on the subject in a TED talk 11 years ago, so it's really not a secret. And believing as I do that this is about an evil enterprise, I have been moved to convert to Christianity. I made this pitch, I made this case in my request for an exemption, and I got it. They gave it to me.
Wow.
Which was a surprise, because I know others here who have requested religious exemptions and not gotten them. So I don't know why, but I did get it. So
I've been worried about you, actually, just on a human level. I've thought, this guy's been put through the ringer already, and now this, what is he going to do? And then I've been thinking, well, I wonder how close to retirement he is. Maybe he'll just do early retirement. Thank goodness you had this happy outcome. I mean, well, you know, as happy as somebody can be at NYU right now.
Yeah, I know. It was a great relief, even though, I forgot to mention that the dean said to me that they finished this review last spring, but decided not to tell me the result because I was on medical leave. I guess that's supposed to mean that they didn't want to upset me. But you know, then the summer went by and the fall went by. So I do rather wish that they had let me know right away, because I was on tenterhooks all that time.
Sure.
But, you know, maybe it sounds churlish to make that point when the takeaway from my conversation with the dean was good news. But yeah, the vaccine mandate is not my personal problem, but I can't pretend that I don't feel it as if it were.
Yeah. Because that's how I feel. I mean, I'm self-employed. It does not touch me at all. But I feel awful for everybody who is touched by it, whose families have been torn up by it, because one side says you should do this, one side says you shouldn't, one side says the kids should get vaccinated, the other one says you shouldn't. It's unbelievably sinister, all the things that have happened. And it's interesting the way you put it, that sometimes people convert religiously because of some extraordinarily good thing that happens to them, or they have some kind of subjective experience of the divine or something like that. There are a lot of reasons people convert. But I could very well understand why somebody would look and say, the unbelievably coordinated force of evil that I am observing is so sinister and coordinated and systematic that it almost defies natural explanation. Well, I could understand that.
That's precisely the case. That is exactly right. And that's the reason why so many people out there continue to dwell in denial. You know, Marshall McLuhan said at one point that, you know, small lies, I can't remember the first part of the quote, but the second is the big lies are protected by public incredulity, that people simply can't believe that the authorities would be so malign, would be so intent on doing such grotesque harm to so many people, including children. I don't any longer see any difference between the so-called democratic West today and Nazi Germany. I know we have tended to be quite complacent and therefore harbored the illusion that was something that they went through. You know, that was a moral collapse that they underwent. You know, they wilted in the face of hideous authoritarian pressure, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it's no longer possible to argue that there's any real difference between here and there, then and now. I mean, it's happening quite explicitly in Austria and Australia and New Zealand and again, Germany. It is looming here, but watching the so-called left serve as a kind of Praetorian guard for the globalists, you know, maybe there's a better metaphor than that. But I see the so-called left now behaving like the educated masses did under Hitler, when it was they in particular who bought Goebbels' propaganda. They who spouted it, the educated, were the worst. The professional classes were actually the worst. I mean, I just reread Victor Klemperer's great diary, I Shall Bear Witness. You know, this is a guy who made it through all 12 years of the Third Reich, he and his wife. He was born Jewish, converted to Protestantism as a young man. But because he was biologically Jewish, they felt almost the full force of the state's harassment and repression. The fact that he had an Aryan wife gave him a little latitude, you know, and allowed him to survive. At any rate, this great diary, which is probably the greatest of the diaries kept and published since the Third Reich, notes from time to time that it was not average working people who would, you know, spout the Judeophobic propaganda out of Goebbels's office, but it was the educated. And it's the same now, right? It's the same now. So as a student of propaganda and a media critic, I have actually been very, very closely tracking the toll of those so-called vaccines. It is beyond grotesque. There really are no words to capture the perverseness and destructiveness and maliciousness of this program, or the unpardonable silence on all of it on the part of our free press, you know. So, yeah, I came to the conclusion that in as much as the entities on top right now, the ones driving this nightmare, are evil. I mean, they are into death. You know, they want absolute control. They're trying to seize control of nature and thwart the best impulses of humanity itself. That's evil, right? That's evil. That's not incompetence. You know, you can't look at how systematically they have recommended measures which make people sicker. There's no way to look at their silence, you know, their failure to mention quite a range of really effective remedies and prophylaxis that would save lives. They have deliberately said nothing about any of that while promoting measures that are demonstrably harmful. That's not incompetence. If you call that incompetence, you are in denial. You can't face what's actually happening here. Well, the point is that once I recognized the nature of the controlling power here, it seemed to me only logical that there has to be something that they're fighting. There has to be some force that is opposed to them and that they detest and that they are doing everything they can to destroy. And I believe that that is, you know, what some would call spirituality. I mean, I'm not in any sense a bigoted or exclusionary Christian. There are people of every faith who are good and who are fighting the good fight here. But in my own case, I realized that I have to take my stand with the other side, right? This time, at a moment when the Pope himself is pushing transhumanism and calls COVID vaccination an act of love, right? There's something deeply wrong with the, you know, Vatican hierarchy, which is completely caved.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the Catholic hierarchy, let's just say I've followed that subject for a long time. And the thing is, the impression people get from the movies and from the media is that the Catholic hierarchy is this immovable force that is dedicated to religious orthodoxy. And that could not be further from the truth. These people are all pushovers. They're all, I don't know where you would, how you could find more spineless people. Almost impossible. It's like the removal of the spine is part of being consecrated as a bishop. And it starts from the top. And I know, I'm sure I have some listeners who will say, well, you shouldn't say such and such. I'm going to say what I want to say because it has to be said. I think this Pope, I think he's an apostate. I don't see any other explanation. I think he's not that bright, but I don't think that that means that therefore he can't be sinister. He's, you know, if they're smart and sinister, that's really, really bad. But dumb and sinister is pretty bad too. Like, you listen to him talk, there are no profundities coming from his mouth. It's all a jumble of meaningless nothingness. It's always meant to undermine and undermine. And I think it's, frankly, I think he hates the faith over which he presides. I'm even going to say that. I see no evidence to the contrary. Sorry, but that's, in fact, no, I'm not even going to say that rhetorical sorry. I'm not sorry. He's the one who should be apologizing, not me.
Amen.
There.
well, actually, yes. I mean, you know, since long before this moment, I have been aware of the corruption of the Vatican. I strongly recommend the book Operation Gladio by Paul Williams, a terrific book, I think the best on the subject. And it's all about the, you know, protracted CIA covert operation entailing the performance of atrocious crimes that would then be blamed on the left, right? This was mainly in Italy that this happened. So far-right former fascist commandos would, you know, like plant bombs at the Bologna train station or, you know, assassinate Aldo Moro and then seed the media with claims that this was all the doing of the Red Brigades. And it was not. At any rate, the book gets into the Vatican's role in that operation.
Oh, but Pope Paul VI was very close with Aldo Moro, I thought.
Well, that may be, but I'm talking about the Vatican hierarchy, you know, not necessarily that particular pope, but okay. There were others, you know, with very, very high positions who were apparently Freemasons, which is mind-boggling because Freemasonry and Catholicism seem to be at odds, at least on paper. And tremendous amount of financial corruption involving the Vatican Bank. But the fact is that really since the early 60s, the Vatican has been moving inexorably against the Catholic faith. I'm agreeing with you wholeheartedly on that point. You know, Malachi Martin, the Catholic purist, I guess you could call him, believed that Vatican II marked the beginning of a transformation of the church into kind of an anti-Catholic bureaucracy, you know. Bergoglio was a fascist tool in South America. That even comes up in the movie The Two Popes, surprisingly, you know, that he actually abetted the military junta and was involved in the complicit in the torture of two priests, you know, who have never forgiven him for what he did. Now he's gone on to serve as a kind of globalist pawn, you know. So there's a large and ever-growing body of Catholics who have turned against the hierarchy on the grounds you've noted. I'm not exactly a Catholic, I want to make clear. I don't really quite know what I am.
Right, but you follow this with interest, as all of us do.
Well, yeah. Indeed. And I do think that there are righteous, many, many righteous Christians and Jews and Muslims who want no part of what's going on and who have the courage to speak out against it. Whereas the left, so-called left, is in a sense the problem, you know, that this whole thing is driven by the so-called left.
Well, somebody like a Pope Francis, I want to shift to something else, can't convincingly answer the question, what do we need the Catholic Church for? What do we need it for? We already have Bill Gates. We already have people who agitate for political causes. We have all that. So what do we need you for? I can get cheeseball, embarrassing music on any Christian praise radio station if that's what I want, because you won't even play, you won't even do Gregorian chant or any of the things that a moviegoer still thinks are being played in Catholic churches. No, they're not. And a moviegoer looks at a Catholic church on the movie screen and thinks, oh, they're elaborate with a lot of embellishments and a fancy altar. You go to your typical parish and it's like a piece of wood and they've bulldozed all the beautiful things out of it. Anyway, listen, I'm telling you, I could never ever stop. What I want to talk about before I forget is, here I have on this program somebody who teaches a course on propaganda, and I'm afraid if I ask you this question that I won't be able to end the episode because you'll have so much to say. But when you look at the use of propaganda in the case of COVID, how does it, when you're in your class, maybe there's a model of propaganda that you use, or you say propaganda tends to have the following characteristics. How closely does COVID conform to that? And is there anything about it that is different or surprising compared to other episodes of propaganda?
Well, yeah. What's different about it is its global scale and its mind-boggling sophistication, right? This is really unprecedented. I mean, we've had totalitarian propagandas in the past, obviously. We had it under Hitler. We had it under the Bolsheviks and the Soviets and so on. But those were regional or national waves of propaganda, fear-mongering propaganda. Propaganda devised to stoke the masses' fear and anger. So we've had that before, and I don't mean to suggest that we've had that only under so-called totalitarian systems, because it was the British and the Americans who first, as it were, road-tested modern propaganda practice in World War I. You know, they managed to demonize the Germans quite brilliantly, so brilliantly that it enabled this cataclysmic world war, right? But we're in a different universe now, Tom. I mean, what we're living under now is just a whole other thing. It's, on the one hand, familiar. On the one hand, it is much like the anti-German propaganda of the First World War, in that it turned the Germans into these contemptible monsters, you know, against whom any kind of force was justified. We've seen this before. Obviously, the way that Hitler and Goebbels gradually demonized and dehumanized the Jews in Germany was another example. And the Bolsheviks too, as with the Nazis, for the sake of the greater good, the Bolsheviks, you know, divided society, created a huge pariah class, mobilized tremendous amounts of hostility and so on, you know. So what we're seeing now is familiar in a sense. This is so much grander in scale, you know.
No doubt. But let me ask you also about the role of technology here, because here we have the full-blown internet. Now, back in the case of the Iraq War, we had the internet, but it wasn't quite as sophisticated and developed and universal as it is now. And at first, I think we all thought this could potentially be an incredible force for liberation for people. And it still is. It's incredible. The kinds of things I can read and access at any time from anywhere in the world, there's still a lot to be said for it. But it could also, it turns out, be used by the bad guys to coordinate propaganda. You would have to have, an unusually independent citizen body to be able to resist propaganda that's coming at you from every nook and cranny of the world. So they've grabbed hold of this technology, and they've used it to push a narrative that might have been harder to push if it were pushed just through newspapers and three TV stations. I feel like this has, even though it's also given us a room for us to try to tell the other side, I wonder if on net, whether this has been a boon or not.
Well, that's a very good question. And it's one that I ask myself often, you know, that it is definitely a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, we do have access to all kinds of information that once would have required, you know, hopping on a plane and going to another city. You know, I'm thinking, for example, of the kind of research that, you know, JFK assassination mavens would have to do back in the day in order to find out something about the other side of the story, right? So the internet makes it extremely easy to get access to all kinds of dissident material. And it also facilitates our community building, allows us to connect with other people of like mind, which is especially important when you're living in a blue bubble, like, say, New York City, where I'm now sitting talking to you. So that you know, those things represent the upside of digital technology. But on the other hand, that technology also enables surveillance so exquisite and total that it would have flabbergasted George Orwell or Joseph Goebbels, you know. I mean, so the surveillance alone is really awesome and deeply worrying. But beyond that, the propaganda works far more effectively in a universe of digital technology because it has enabled so many people to turn themselves into vectors of the propaganda, right? People on Facebook, people on Twitter, they are media through which this crap gushes, you know. Someone just wrote to me, I forget his name, but he's a professor, I believe, in Europe. He wrote a piece about horizontal propaganda. He makes the interesting point that online gatherings enable a kind of horizontal propaganda, whereby all kinds of regular people, they comprise a kind of propaganda militia. They simply parrot the propaganda claims that they've absorbed from the New York Times and CNN and the rest of them. So that's kind of a new thing.
Now, I have a friend who speculates about the origins of that. He says that he believes that there are a lot of people, and he says maybe we're hardwired for this from all the way back when we lived tribal or nomadic existences. If you were driven from the tribe, you'd be dead. You'd have no means of survival. So there are some people who have stuck to this, I have to be part of the in-group, I have to not dissent, I have to protect what the people above me and the cool people believe, and if anybody dissents from that, I have to join them in demonizing them. And so it becomes a kind of a way of, it's all about social status. I have to be part of the in-group. So the in-group says, a Trump vaccine would be too dangerous, so I'll say that. And then a year later, I'll say exactly the opposite of that because that's what is necessary for me not to be left out of the tribe.
Yeah, that's quite true. I mean, but let's never forget that this whole thing is founded on a basis of panic. You know, it's based on panic that people have been so terrorized by this COVID bogey. They are concerned above all else, some means of self-salvation, some way in which they might save themselves. And they have bought the satanic suggestion that they can protect themselves from death by getting jabbed as many times as possible, by masking their own children, by getting their children injected, you know. The panic has made people deeply irrational. It has had a stupefying effect so that they absolutely cannot reason, you know. They can't reason. They can't absorb counter evidence, you know. It only makes them angry. And I can't stress this strongly enough. It's not working people who are thus, you know, kind of mentally impaired, cognitively impaired. It's the educated primarily who feel deeply threatened by any other point of view. And there is no point in arguing with them, you know. I mean, one tries and tries and tries. It's really pointless. It's a waste of time. The only thing that will change their minds, if anything can, and in some cases, nothing can. The only thing that may change their minds, and that has changed many minds, is when their own experience, their own traumatic experience, is completely antithetical to what they've been absorbing from the propaganda, right? Something horrible happens to them or someone close to them, so that in their own sphere, they encounter quite vivid and irresistible evidence.
And that breaks them out of it. That can break them out of it.
That can break them out of it.
Maybe you know, I guess you know the name Alex Berenson. He was banned from Twitter for saying things we now know to be true.
Right.
But and we kind of knew them at the time he was saying them. But he has a newsletter. And I guess he was saying the other day that he's mentally dividing the country now into three groups. 30% of people are going to believe the CDC no matter what they say, no matter how absurd it is. Another 30% just don't believe any of this. And then there's that 40% that's kind of uncommitted, that more or less goes with the flow. If everybody's wearing masks, they'll wear masks. If the masks come off, they take the masks off. He says, forget about the 30% wedded to the CDC. That's just hopeless. You're just going to waste your time. Go after this 40%. And I do believe there's a little bit of movement, a little bit of movement with that 40%. There's some interesting polling data that came out from Monmouth University just the other day that suggests that this 40% is getting extremely restless and they're just not going to continue with this in perpetuity. So that, I think that's a reasonable strategy. Now, by the way, before I forget, you send out a dispatch, I think, that my people might find interesting. If they wanted to get it, how would they?
Oh, you're talking about my listserv?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's News from Underground. Every day I send out as many emails as I can, highlighting various bits of news that are extremely important that have been blacked out or distorted by the media. In order to get on that listserv, one need only go to markcrispinmiller.com and sign up for, I guess you could call it a newsletter. And I recommend, if people don't want their inboxes filling up with what I send, that they choose the Daily Digest option, which will mean that they'll just get one email a day with all that day's links in it. People can do that, and they may also want to subscribe to me on Substack, through which I send out my own little writings, you know, a few times a week.
Okay, so I'll make sure that's up on the show notes page. That's tomwoods.com/2029. All right, I think we're going to just cut it. I mean, honestly, you and I could just, I was thinking to myself, next time I'm in New York, which I don't even use that phrase anymore, next time I'm in New York, because there's nothing I can do in New York now, I'd love to have lunch with you.
But oh, I'd love that.
I don't know where we could go. Would be the problem.
Well, there are places one can go. You know, I mean, this raises the whole question of just how enforceable all this ultimately is. Now, to the extent that we succumb to the, you know, fatal desire for greater convenience, right? Above all, to that extent, we are at serious risk of losing this struggle. However, I have to be honest and say, I don't think we can ultimately lose. I mean, we've been speaking in a kind of a dark vein today, as is inevitable lately. But I actually think that what they're trying to do is so grandiose, it is so psychotic, you know, it's so ambitious that they can't really win. You know, it may feel from time to time and here and there as if they have won, But I don't think they ultimately can, because you can't do this to nature. You know, you can't really do this to humanity itself. It brings us back to the story of the Tower of Babel. It's really ultimately impossible. But I don't think that that kind of metaphysical view should make us complacent. I think that we do have to keep on telling the truth as relentlessly and as noisily and as lucidly as possible. And I want to say something about Berenson's mental division of the national audience into three different groups. That's actually a rather old idea. Interestingly, Sam Adams, you know, the American revolutionary, in one of his letters, makes a very similar observation. You know, that there is, I'd say, roughly a third of the people were intent on independence from the British Empire. A third were Tories, right, who did not want America to be independent. And then there were those who were mostly concerned about, I think Adams uses the word knitting, you know, that they're basically interested in their creature comforts and, you know, living their life day to day and being comfortable. And, you know, I think that's really quite comparable to Berenson's observation, which others have made too. So, you know, I do believe that it is up to this third of us who get it and who will not tolerate what's going on. It's up to us to bring that, you know, more or less open-minded third or 40% around. And I also want to say that I actually think that we have, by now, majority support, that we do actually represent the majority. Now, if you look at how online discourse is manipulated, how AstroTurf is all over the place, you know, that's the practice of creating fake grassroots voices or groups, you know, which are actually corporate controlled. You know, like the tobacco industry did that with smokers' rights groups that were meant to seem like spontaneous, organic eruptions of mass sentiment. They weren't. They were backed by the tobacco industry. This kind of thing is quite common. And today, it's become decisive. You may go online and see millions of comments on, say, Twitter or, you know, Facebook that appear to represent a majority strongly supporting what's going down. But as Cheryl Atkinson has demonstrated, you know, in her book, The Smear, and in subsequent interviews, that's often the result of extremely clever and effective fakery, you know, that one guy can basically be operating under 20 different names, you know, and we'll have a network of other operatives whose job it is to create a fake consensus, you know, precisely so that we who are fighting what's going on have the demoralizing feeling that we're completely outnumbered when in fact we're not. And this relates also to the psychological effect of election theft. I mean, you know, it just occurs to me now that, I mean, it used to be the Republicans who routinely stole elections. I mean, I wrote a couple of books about this. You know, now it's the Democrats, right? When you steal an election, you know, you have not only illegitimately placed the wrong person or persons in power, but you also foster the illusion that those who represent the real majority are in a small minority. See, it's clear to me by now that many, many people who have had one shot will not get the second shot. Many who've gotten both shots will not get a booster. And many who have gotten a booster will get a second booster. You know, with every wave of quote unquote vaccination, with every wave of such, you know, mass injection, the number of its grassroots supporters shrinks a little bit.
Yes, that's right. They are adding to our ranks every time they push.
Exactly. And thank God, it appears that a very small minority of parents are having their young children injected. It's something like 17%, you know.
Yeah, very small. And you know how this works. We've seen it with adults, that the people really enthusiastic about it go out and right away they do it because they're panicked. But right. Once that initial wave subsides, then it's just a trickle after that, and especially with children. So are you really going to exclude all these people from society forever?
Well, yeah. I mean, the numbers of the excluded are so much larger than the numbers of, say, you know, the Jews and communists in Nazi Germany, or the so-called kulaks, you know, in the Soviet Union. We're talking here about, you know, at the very least, a solid third of the whole population. Are they going to stick a whole third of the population in concentration camps? How can they do that, especially when, as we just agreed, you know, the number of the fervently supportive keeps on shrinking? So, you know, this seems to me to be evidence that, further evidence that they can't really pull it off. Now, what this means, Tom, what this means is that they will have to keep on serially shocking the system with further collective traumas, you know. I mean, we know now, as of, say, yesterday, that they have already wargamed a huge crippling cyber attack that will paralyze the world's financial system. They have already wargamed this. It was maybe 3 weeks ago. 10 countries participated in this drill, you know. They'll do that. They'll shut down the financial system, or they will, you know, shut off the food supply through this manipulation of the supply chains and the destruction of farmland and the absorption of farmland by the likes of Bill Gates and Ted Turner. You know, they will keep on jolting the body politic with these crippling and horrifying shocks in the hope that it will continue to make people docile and compliant. I don't think anybody's ever really done this before, right? I mean, I know other people who were, you know, struck by 9/11 and are still investigating it, that they sort of assumed that 9/11 was a once-in-a-lifetime thing, you know, that they would do that, and then they would let the chips fall where they may, et cetera, and they'd have their war on terror, blah, blah, blah. But it now appears that they are willing to do this time after time after time, and at ever shorter intervals, you know. And that raises the practical question of whether or not that can work, you know. At what point will people be unshockable, desensitized, completely incredulous, you know? I mean, anybody with a working brain is now incredulous, it seems to me. And as we just agreed, you know, the number of the incredulous keeps growing, right? So, I mean, I don't have an answer to this question. Can they simply shock the masses time and time again, every 6 months? Can they do it as often as they would have us take boosters, you know? At what point will people say, forget it? You know, to what extent is Lincoln's, you know, famous aphorism about fooling all the people all the time, you know, whether that will continue to apply? I really don't know, because we're in uncharted territory.
Well, indeed. And I think back again, as I've said before, when I think back to 2019, oh, I had complaints about the world in 2019, Mark, but I would take 2019 in a second, and the level of problems I was facing then in terms of you know, my beliefs and the lack of conformity to those beliefs of the world, I would be glad. It's like I would gladly take Bill Clinton. I remember Bill Clinton was demonized, absolutely demonized by the GOP, and I understand that. There are plenty of things to dislike about Bill Clinton, but geez, after George W. Bush and, you know, and this COVID regime, I would gladly have Bill Clinton, not Hillary. I think Bill is much more sensible and restrained and less ideological, is my feeling. But I would almost rather have that. And I know he's a terrible person, but that's how bad things are, that I'd rather have some horror from 25 years ago, because it seems attractive compared to now. All right, look, I got to put a cap on this, because if I release five of these a week, I can only expect people to have so much free time. Okay. So I do have to put a lid on it. But I hope we can have some surreptitious lunch one of these days, if I can get up there. But let me remind everybody, the website, markcrispinmiller.com. I'll link to that also at tomwoods.com/2029. Well, Mark, thank you so much you're extremely generous with your time. And I'm glad you've had some good news from your corner of the world. And just keep plugging away.
Well, I will. You too. It's always bracing to talk to you and to read you, you know, and to listen to you. So you're one of the essential good ones, Tom.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. All right, everybody, before we go, I want to tell you about a clever Tom Wood Show listener who came up with something really, really neat. I'm sure you've all used Groupon. You can save a lot of money on a lot of different things. It gives you an opportunity to try things you're not sure you want to try because you get a good discount. You figure, well, what's the harm? I'll give it a try. And of course, a lot of your social media friends, or at least on Facebook, let's say, they live near you. You know, you have friends from your hometown or whatever. You have a lot of people who live near you. And so if you say, hey, here's a fun thing to do that I like to do, and you have a Groupon thing for them, well, they're going to love that. Well, the thing is, Groupon will actually pay you a commission if somebody actually goes and gets that Groupon. You actually make a commission. And you're obviously helping your friends. You're saving them a ton of money. And you also make a commission, doing something you would do anyway. So a listener of the Tom Wood Show is showing you how to do this very, very easily. You could make a whole website full of deals just for one particular part of the country, and all the links will give you commissions. It's an easy way to do good, to do well by doing good. First, you're getting exposure for a lot of merchants. A lot of times they use Groupon because nobody's ever heard of them, and this gets attention for them. So you're helping merchants get attention at a time when merchants are being beaten down by irrationality and hatred in our society. Secondly, you're helping people who live in that area save a little money and have some experiences that they will value. And you're helping yourself by making some commissions. So it's a site worth looking at because it'll help you do that. And it's called localdealgenerator.com. So it basically helps you get set up with Groupon as something that you, you know, earn commissions from. There's nothing wrong with earning commissions. We're not communists on the Tom Wood Show. This is a good thing. It's a win-win-win. So check out his site, localdealgenerator.com. Use coupon code WOODS, and for a very, very limited time, take 25% off. I'll link to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2029. And remember, you can get nice publicity for your website or blog from me, and all you have to do is use my link to get your hosting, and you get a great price and a lot of great bonuses from me that cost you nothing. So check out the details on that at tomwoods.com/publicity. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Wood Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.